Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm here this week with Russ Chianelli and a special guest who's from the Environmental Molecular Toxicology Department at Oregon State University.
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio David E. Williams. David, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, we like to start these programs by sort of digging into David for a little bit. Tell us how you got into science. What were the stimulations that gave you that sort of a career as opposed to any other?
Okay. Well, I grew up in Yakima, Washington, which is kind of in central Washington. My father is a MD, a gastroenterologist. So I kind of always expected that – I think it was expected of me that I'd go into the same field. And for a while, I thought that's what I wanted to do. So I ended up going to a small liberal arts college in Portland called Reed College.
Oh, really?
Which was a very strange place in the 70s, by the way. And I majored in biology there. And it was right about that time Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, was really having a lot of impact. And that's what really got me interested in science and environmental toxicology issues was that book. Like for our organic chemistry lab, we had to do our own projects. And I synthesized DDT, which is probably pretty stupid now to do that out in the open lab. But I was so interested in that work. And then I used that DDT that I made for a project in our neuroscience course.
Have you noticed that you don't whistle as much these days as you did when you were younger?
Well, I probably have. You know, it has a very long half-life in the human body stored in fat tissue. And I know I must still have, considering you can't see me on radio, but I have plenty of adipose tissue for it to be stored in. And besides that, making the open lab, there was this one time a friend of mine and I had this little grant from an outfit called Mazamas in Oregon. They're mountaineering, outdoor kind of. They gave us money to study the breakdown of DDT in the air after spraying. And this was after DDT was outlawed, by the way. But Oregon got a special permit to lift that ban to spray for the tussock moth in eastern Oregon because it was just decimating Douglas fir out there. So me and my buddy went out there with some instrumentation to collect the air and look at the breakdown products of DDT in the air. And I think we were good scientists, but we were terrible map readers because we thought we were on the edge of the spray zone. And we woke up in the morning, got out of our tents to the sound of helicopters, and all of a sudden these helicopters come down over the ridge and they just dumped everything right on us.
Oh, my God.
So yeah, I'm sure I've got plenty of DDT stored up in me.
Well, it probably means you don't get bitten by mosquitoes. I don't know if there's a logic to that comment. But
yeah, and so at Reed College we have to do an undergraduate thesis. So I decided to do it with PCBs. And at first I was going to work with trout. And I was going to expose them to a very low concentration of a single PCB in the water and look how it affected steroid metabolism in the liver. So I went out, drove out my little Volkswagen Bug to a fish hatchery in central Oregon and then drove all the way back. This was like 2 in the morning with the windows rolled down so the fish would stay cool. You know, rainbow trout to stay cool and they were in some garbage bags with water. So anyway, I get back to the college about 3 in the morning and I'm setting up the tanks in the cold walk-in cold room and everything's fine and I go home and get some sleep. I come back in the morning, they're all belly up. They had a power outage that night after I went home. And so my professor, who was an embryologist, said, why don't you just work with frogs? So I switched and I did it with frogs. I exposed them to PCBs, that one PCB in their diet for a certain length of time and then looked at the change in steroid metabolism. It was
and
funny.
Did you publish that work?
No, it had some problems, and the biggest problem I ran into was the source of the frogs because I wanted to look at real low level environmentally relevant kinds of exposures, and we were buying the frogs from an outfit in Wisconsin that happened to be near Green Bay, and it turned out when the frogs came in, they were so loaded with PCBs already that the background was so high I couldn't see any additional effect from adding the small amount, you know. So I had to wait about 3 months for them in clean water, clean diet, before the levels got down low enough that I could see any effect from my adding a small amount to their diet.
So the half-life of the PCBs in fatty tissue is quite long.
Yes, yes. They're very fat soluble, just like DDT is, so they will stay in the body
so
a long time.
The rainbow trout died. The frogs were already contaminated.
That's research.
So well-planned research, right?
Well, actually, it really prepared me well for graduate school because by the time I decided I wanted to go to graduate school, I'd been acquainted with the ups and downs of research and I think that really allows a student to hit the ground running. So I think schools that have like honor colleges and other things where they're required to do undergraduate research, I think is really beneficial for the student if they're going to go on to graduate school because
– see what it's like.
Yeah. It was very, very beneficial for me. And so for my PhD, I went back to the rainbow trout and I purified – cytochrome P450 out of their liver.
And what does that do?
Cytochrome P450 is the major enzyme in your body that metabolizes foreign compounds, drugs, and what we call xenobiotics or foreign chemicals.
It's a molybdenum enzyme, isn't it?
No, it's actually an iron-containing enzyme.
Iron.
It's got a protoporphyrin ring.
Oh, okay.
And it oxidizes foreign compounds that are really fat-soluble and makes them more water-soluble so you can excrete them. For instance, cytochrome P450-3A4, there's a number of different forms of cytochrome P450, metabolizes about 60% of all drugs. The cytochrome P450 will take, for example, a benzene ring and hydroxylate it, right. So stick an OH group on it. And now it's more polar, easy to excrete. Plus, it's now a substrate for a second group of enzymes called the phase two enzymes, and they can stick a carbohydrate on that hydroxyl group or sulfate or anything.
Onto anything almost.
Even more polar.
Right.
Yeah, because now it'll be charged. So then it's very easy to excrete. So it's really how the body handles foreign chemicals. Otherwise, rather than a half-life of months to years, we'd never get rid of any of these chemicals. They'd stay in our bodies about forever.
You know, the talking about DDT and Rachel Carlson and all that kind of stuff, you know that there's a worldwide ban on shipping DDT into Africa,
mm-hmm.
and that's causing a huge problem for them with malaria.
Yes.
And they're kind of saying, well, you know, you guys wiped it out. Why can't we? So do you have any comments about that?
Well, it's not just a scientific issue. I guess it's a political issue, and people smarter than me have to figure out the risk-benefit of the whole
thing. Oh, but it is a scientific issue.
Yeah, sure it is. And
I mean,
it's not
that's a bit of a cop-out because either
certainly the politicians aren't smarter than you.
Well, okay. I was being chicken. I've seen the statistics on death rates from malaria during use of DDT and then after it was banned, and those numbers are pretty surprising. Malaria was almost wiped out in some of these
effective
countries. And what's surprising to me is that there hasn't been a reasonably effective substitute found. I mean, you can do things like
more
mosquito netting
and
other things. But as far as a chemical pesticide that's as effective as DDT, they just haven't come up with anything.
And
maybe
it's
the non-biodegradability that's the key.
Yeah. Well, certainly, because it stays around so long. The other – probably the largest class of pesticides used are the organophosphates, but they have low chronic toxicity because they disappear so quickly in the environment. But they have very high acute toxicity. So it's just the opposite of DDT. DDT is not very toxic acutely. I mean, there used to be this – I call him a clown, but it's probably a little harsh. But just to prove that DDT wasn't that dangerous, this guy used to eat a teaspoon of it every day.
Yeah.
So it isn't, at least to humans, not that acutely toxic. It's the chronic toxicity that's the problem.
Yeah. Was he a scientist or is he just an ornithologist?
A pseudoscientist might
wow.
be a generous description. But I think he was someone who worked for, I don't know if it was DuPont
just, okay,
or whoever it was. But
a consultant.
Yeah.
Yeah, we
with
all.
Is he still with us?
As far as I know, I mean, we actually had a faculty member at Oregon State who had the same viewpoint on 2,4-5-T. 2,4-5-T and 2,4-D were the herbicides that were made up Agent Orange used in Vietnam. And, of course, the problem with that was that during the manufacture of that herbicide, the dioxin was a byproduct. TCD was a byproduct of that manufacture. So there were literally, I don't know how much TCD ended up being dropped to try to defoliate. You know, they were trying to defoliate the jungle so that the couldn't bring supplies down from the north. But they're still studying populations in Vietnam to this day for long-term effects from the dioxin exposure.
So your colleague at Oregon State, what did he do?
Well, what he did was he took 2,4-5-T and he applied it on his skin every day. I mean, he would just kind of paint it on his legs. And it was worse than that. It was not only doing it to himself, he got some of his students to do it too. That's just a big no-no. I mean, you know.
Does it cause rashes or was it?
Well, not that I know of, but, you know, there was a big scare right about that time. In fact, that's what prompted him to start doing that because there was an epidemiology study that was associating the use of 2,4-5-T by the Forest Service in Oregon with a high incidence of birth defects in an area around a place called Alsea, Oregon. And so I think that was his motivation. He got a lot of funding from the Forest
Service. Is this why you referred to the 70s as being strange at Reed College, or were there other
reasons? Actually, this was at Oregon State. Reed College was strange, but for other reasons. I mean, it was, sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
The good old days.
You're
listening to Science Studio, and we're going to take a break and talk about sex, sex, lies, and whatever else.
I guess I got off topic, didn't
no,
I?
No, no. Yeah.
My sister went to Reed before, my older sister, and when I went down there, she bought me the sweatshirt at the bookstore, and it had an emblem on the sweatshirt that said, free love, atheism, communism. And it was kind of the emblem, you know.
Isn't that where we are now?
Actually, I've been back up to Reed College.
One of those isms seems to be out.
I've been back up to Reed College, and you'd be surprised how
more conservative it is.
Yeah, I mean, the students now are a lot more interested in making money than they are in making statements, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
And to, you know, whether that's—
You mean actually being productive.
Well, not just that, but, you know, Reed had a sense of humor too back then. I mean, like, John Mitchell, the Attorney General at the time, paid a visit to Reed College.
Yeah.
And instead of having an angry demonstration kind of thing, the students decided, well, let's do something fun and sarcastic. And so they lined up the driveway coming into the college, and they all dressed up as cheerleaders. And as his limo came in the driveway, they started doing these cheers of, justice, justice, yay, just, you know, just, and but it went right over his head, you know.
Yeah, right.
He didn't get it at all. And then he was waving and smiling.
You have a movie of that. Somebody should have taken a movie.
I'm sure there may be one somewhere, you know. But.
Well, that seems like a good place to take a break away from sex and drugs and rock and roll. This is Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Kinelli, and a sexy, druggy rock and roller, David Williams.
Oh, am I in trouble?
Oregon State University. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Our immune system weakens with age. After about 75 or 80, we're pretty much open season to the bugs out there.
So, I've still got another half century to go.
Norbert, your picture's on the website.
Oh, yeah, but wait. A new study shows I'm as good as my 20s when it comes to a specialized class of immune cells. My body's cellular immunity, which kills virus-infected cells, remains just as active today.
This is significant because some vaccines, such as the flu vaccine, don't trigger cellular immunity when maybe they should. Instead, the flu vaccine triggers antibodies, which studies now show don't work as well in older people since they don't produce enough of them.
An antibody is a protein that attaches to viruses and virus-infected cells to mark them for elimination, whereas cellular immunity involves T cells that kill infected cells and memory T cells which recognize a reinfection. We assume these cells also declined with age.
To test that presumption, researchers took blood from people infected with one of three types of viruses, the West Nile virus and two common herpes viruses.
After dividing the people into three age groups, researchers measured the numbers and activities of their T cells, specifically ones called CD8-positive T cells that kill viruses.
Surprisingly, the over 60 group produced the same number of these immune cells compared to the under 40 group. It suggests older people could benefit more from vaccines if manufacturers changed them to stimulate cellular immunity.
That's possible by switching from a dead to a live weakened virus. There is a live flu vaccine that appears to be effective, but for now, it's not approved in the U.S. for people over 50.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back, Science Studio, Keith Pannell, David Williams, Russ Chianelli. And we're going to now talk about some of the aspects of toxicology and models used to study toxicology. David, tell us, what's the big deal about the rainbow trout? Why is that such a popular, not only to eat for some of us, but as a model for toxicology studies?
Well, I mean, what other animal can you eat your controls? I mean, well, I guess there is lobster. I know Margaret James down in Florida studies lobster.
And this anyway, program is funded by the National Institutes of Health, who will be very interested in that last comment.
We found a very, I think, important niche and use for this rainbow trout model. They're very sensitive to a number of human carcinogens, especially aflatoxin. Aflatoxin is produced by a mold, Aspergillus flavus, that grows on things like corn and peanuts. And it's a very potent liver carcinogen. And in parts of China, liver cancer is the number one cause of all death in males. And part of it's due to high rates of hepatitis infection, but it's also related to high levels of aflatoxin in the diet, because the mold grows well in hot, moist climates, and they have poor post-harvest storage, and so it's just high amounts in their diet. So anyway, what we can do with the rainbow trout, see, is we can do studies that you just could never do in a rat or a mouse just because of the cost issue. We've done two of these studies now with about 40,000 trout. Now, the largest cancer study ever done in a mouse was with 25,000 mice, and that was with a compound called 2-acetylaminofluorine, which is a bladder and liver carcinogen. And see, that the whole problem is that the regulatory agencies are mandated to determine the risk to the general population of a chemical that would cause one cancer in a million people. Okay, so how do you do that with animals? I mean, it's obviously you can't raise a million animals, and even then you'd be looking for one cancer in a million. So what you have to do is extrapolate the dose from the experiments you can do all the way down to – so for most rodent experiments, maybe you'll get the dose that causes one cancer in 10 animals statistically. And then you have to extrapolate that down five orders of magnitude, 100,000-fold down to the level of exposure that would cause one cancer in a million people. Well, that's all guesswork. I mean, what the EPA and others do is usually do a linear extrapolation, just draw a straight line through the data. And maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong. It's probably a conservative estimate, but you know, that's if you're going to err, you want to be err on that side. But what we can do with the rainbow trout is because we can – use so many of them, and they have such a low background incidence of cancer, we were able to find the dose of a human carcinogen that produced one cancer in 5,000 animals.
So you put it in there and the trout developed cancer as well?
We put it in their diet.
And they developed the cancer.
And they developed the cancer.
Now, what period of time? I mean, how do you – are these – you take them when they're babies? How long does a trout live? I don't know.
Well, that's a good question, because that is one of the issues that – regulatory agencies have been dealing with, because in the rodent studies, they just usually do lifetime exposures, you know, pretty much from weaning to death. Most rodents live a year and a half to 2 years. Trout are pretty much indefinite. They'll grow and who knows.
So these legends about a trout that's 50 years old in some lake are true.
I might be a skeptical about 50 years, but we can't grow them past 3 years because they just eat like pigs and they get to be – no, we have spawning tanks because we do all our own spawning at our fish lab. And so we grow them out to 3 years old, and they're about 10-pound trout. They're really not – I mean, everybody that goes out there to visit the lab wants to get a fishing pole from us.
Well, I mean, that's the question there. I mean, you do this and then you have to dissect all these trouts and look for the cancer?
Yeah. We just got done doing an experiment with almost 40,000 animals. But it only took us about 6 weeks to do all the necropsies because.
So that means actually you're filleting them. I mean, a necropsy is.
Well, we just open them up and look at the liver. For this experiment was we knew the cancer would only be in liver, so we didn't have to look at the other organs.
Oh, okay.
So
it didn't. I mean, do you eat the ones that are non-carcinogenic?
Well, you know, it's funny. We used to have a party at the end of the year where we would have all the students out and have a barbecue, until one of the students asked the question one day of us. Are you sure this is the control? And that was it. I mean, we decided we don't want this liability. We, you know, somebody gets liver cancer 20 years from now and comes back and sues us. So we just quit doing that.
So what do? I mean, do you give it for animal
feed? We toss
feed,
them or? In the dumpster when we're done with them, which is kind of sad.
Now, okay, so now they're up to 3 years old. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
That particular
we
group.
Spawn
so
them
that's in a sense, and correct me when I go wrong, that's essentially giving a toxic material to almost a newborn baby, a young person, where the whole metabolism is very different from that if you gave it to somebody at 45, so a four-year-old, and looked at them for 3 years.
Well, actually what we do is we start the treatment when they're about, 3 months old.
Yeah, right.
So they start feeding in about a month after their spawn, and we feed them for either 4 to 8 weeks. So that's the big difference between a cancer study in a mouse or a rat that the EPA or the FDA will do. Because they feed them for the whole lifetime, but we can't afford to do that because the fish just get so big. So we just do it for a certain period and then use that data.
And then – but you let them go to the three-year
– No, we don't have – they develop the cancer by a year of age. So the experiments go –
So the experiment's one-year
for
experiment.
One year.
So
right.
my point then, if you took the big ones, you let them grow for 3 years, 4 years, did the eight-week regimen then, and then come back in the fifth year – that would seem to me to be an interesting experiment on the basis of the fact that, you know, you always think that young growing children and young growing animals in general are more prone to suffer poor effects of diet.
Yeah. Well, we've always wanted to do that because, like you said, we would expect to see the cancer rates, the size of the tumor increase with age just like they do in humans. But like I said, we just could never afford to grow up that many enough to do a decent experiment to that age because, like I said, they just get so big. They take up so much water and space. And
so what have you found? Okay, you've done the experiments.
Okay.
And
well, with the first chemical we used, which is a compound called dibenzoalpyrene, it's a polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon. And what that is, it's a series of chemicals that are formed from the burning of any organic material, especially petroleum products. And so they're becoming a real problem in the environment because with the increased energy demand and the increased burning of coal especially. And actually, we just were awarded a Superfund grant.
Hundreds of lakes and tar sands in Canada with these things floating around.
Oh, yeah. It's getting to be a major problem. And we just got a Superfund grant to study these things. And one of the things we're looking at is formation in China because China –
blame it on China. Yeah, let's go.
Well, I'm not going to – I've done one of these – I've done a radio interview before – no, actually a TV interview before. And when I got done with it, I realized it sounded like I was China bashing, and I don't mean to do that because we get 50% of our energy from coal. So we're guilty too, but except we burn it a little cleaner, I would say. But they get 70 to 80% of their energy from coal.
And they're going to get more because they've said that.
Yeah.
And it's one of these things like the DDT question. You burned it and developed. We're going to burn it and develop.
Every week, two new coal-fired plants come online large enough to power the city the size of Dallas. I mean, that's how much they're – and what happens is they get in the jet stream and they come over the West Coast and they're here in about 6 days. And they also react with chemicals in the atmosphere on the way over and they get more toxic. And it's been estimated on any given day, like in L.A., up to a third of the smog, the particulate matter – which the PHs are bound to, comes from China. So it's a significant problem. So we're studying those. But anyway, in the trout, what we found out was that rather than staying linear as you got down to lower and lower dose, the cancer rate started to drop off. So that by the time that hit one in a million, the linear line would have told you a dose that was about 1,000-fold lower than what we actually
saw. So there was sort of a critical concentration or something like that above which – it
right.
would have an effect and below what you wouldn't.
Yeah, there was a 1,000-fold difference in that estimate of what dose of the chemical would cause one cancer in a million between the EPA model and what our data were actually saying.
So which way?
Well, ours would have said that it would take 1,000 times more of the chemical to cause that one cancer in a million.
Okay.
So it was actually – and that's a big deal because if you're cleaning up a Superfund site – getting the levels of the compound down to one part per trillion versus one part per billion, which is a 1,000-fold difference, is a lot of money.
Yeah, that's right.
But we did another experiment with a different carcinogen, and this time instead of dropping off like that as you got to down lower doses, it stayed linear all the way down.
Go back to the China. I mean, is there an incredibly high incidence of liver cancer in China?
There is. As I said before, in parts of China, like in Shandong province.
But I mean, taking the demographics nationally.
It's regionally. Yeah. It's regionally. There are hot spots like in Shandong province is where we've studied a population, and that's where the rates are incredibly high. And they have, like I said, both the problem of high HBV, HCV, the hepatitis B and C virus infection rates, plus the aflatoxin in the diet. That just seems to cause the incredibly high rate.
Listening to you, though, there's another problem which I think is hurting us internationally with the EPA and these projections to 1 in 1,000,000, and that is there was a news story just as we're broadcasting here that over 600 biotech companies in the U.S. are going under, and they're going under because they can't afford to overcome these regulations. Mm-hmm. And we're really losing a lot of potential cures because we're overregulated. I mean, you must feel that in what you're doing to see how these things adjust to those regulations. You're sort of saying it didn't make much sense to project to 1 in 1,000,000.
But, well, it makes sense in some cases, but not in others. Yeah, and therefore, it's prudent to be cautious.
Some things are potent.
If you know that if you're sick and there is a drug that may be cost 3 in 1,000,000, you sign something so nobody gets sued and say, yeah, I'll try it. We have to have these, I'm proselytizing a little bit here, but we cannot lose this tremendous advantage we have in developing these cures, and we are.
Yeah. Maybe there's a better way to spend money, and that is to go to the source and make cleaner coal, do processes more efficiently.
Sure, there's a lot of things you can do.
Chasing the end is perhaps the most costly. Why not chase the beginning?
Yeah, I've always been interested in prevention, and we've used the rainbow trout for cancer prevention studies, but lately I've gotten into another model, which I want to talk about for a minute, and that's a mouse model of pregnancy. I'm with the Linus Pauling Institute, and so we're very interested in prevention of disease. And I've always been interested in the idea of, well, we know we can give people high levels of fruits and vegetables in their diet and protect them from a lot of cancers. Why can't we supplement a pregnant mother's diet with these compounds and protect the fetus from chemicals that can cross the placenta? And because we know the fetus is more sensitive than the adult to these a lot of these chemical carcinogens. So I got a model for this where we give a pregnant mouse a carcinogen near the end of her pregnancy, and her offspring, most of them die from a severe T-cell lymphoma between 3 and 6 months of age. If they survive that, 100% of them have multiple lung tumors, and the males have liver tumors, and it's very potent. But if we give the mother indole-3-carbinol in her diet, and indole-3-carbinol is a major constituent of cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, we can cut the cancer rate in her offspring by over half, even though the offspring never get it in their diet. It's just whatever they got across the placenta or through nursing, because we also give it to the mother while she's nursing. But after that, once they're weaned, the mice never see the indole-3-carbinol. But just giving it to the mother during pregnancy and nursing, we can protect her offspring very significantly from the cancer that they were exposed to in utero.
We'll do another program with
you. Okay, that's a deal.
But we've run out of our time.
Okay.
David Williams from Oregon State University, thank you very much for being here. And Russ, do you want to say a few words?
Yeah, just please come back soon to Science Studio, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
Well, thank you for having me, and anyone out there interested in the research is welcome to go to the Linus Pauling Institute homepage. It's easy to get to on the web and learn more about what's going on there.
Absolutely, and we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. On May 7th, University Medical Center at El Paso started scanning the palms of patients' hands as part of its registration process. The new biometric technology uses near-infrared light to capture vein patterns. The new system enables faster and more accurate patient identification. Read more at Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.